Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Just a reminder that this is a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking any calls. Well, Jonathan Foer is well known to many of you for his creative and imaginative writing style. In his novels, everything is illuminated and extremely loud and incredibly close. A few years ago, he became a new dad, and he started to wonder, as many parents do, what exactly he was feeding his son, specifically about the meat his son was eating. So, being an author, he wrote a book about it, this time nonfiction, called Eating Animals. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks so much for coming in for this.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the book. You're a well-known fiction writer. Why a nonfiction book?
I wouldn't have chosen it, to be honest. I felt compelled to write it when I faced the prospect of having to make these food choices on someone else's behalf, as every father, every mother does. I guess I took the questions very seriously. I'd been an on-and-off vegetarian since I was a kid, but and very on and very off, I should say. The pendulum swung pretty far in each direction. And my choices were always based on instincts, and that didn't feel like enough.
Your book has garnered attention from Natalie Portman, who said on the Huffington Post that after reading it, she went vegan. But our listeners certainly know there have been a lot of books about factory farming and vegetarianism. Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, has been here 100 times. What do you add here that's really new? What did you find out that you really didn't know?
In fact, there haven't been a lot of books about meat or about factory farming. And Michael Pollan is one of the best food writers in the country right now, glances on the subject, and he takes it to the place where I think it gets really, really interesting, but then stops a bit short. So what you'll often hear is that there's this thing that exists, factory farming. We know the gist. We don't know the details. We know it's unpleasant. We know if we see a video from one of these farms, we're not going to like what we see. We know if we hear the details about the environmental effects, we're going to be uncomfortable with them. But what isn't talked about is the breadth of factory farming. 99%, more than 99% of all animals raised for meat in this country come from factory farms. Unfortunately, it's often talked about as if it's one problem among many instead of being the rule.
A factory farm. You broke into a factory farm with a group of activists. Do I understand that correctly?
It's not how I would describe it. I didn't break any laws when seeing any of these farms. There is an incredible veil of secrecy. I mean, in fact, this was – of all the things I found, that veil of secrecy was the thing that scared me most. It scared me much more
– Talk about it.
– than anything I saw in any slaughterhouse. You know, if you wanted to know where your grape juice comes from, it wouldn't be all that hard to get an invitation to the orchard. If you wanted to find out how your bagel is made, the guys at the deli will let you behind the counter. But meat is the great exception in the American diet. I would invite you, I would encourage you, I would invite and encourage all of everyone listening to this right now to try to go to the kind of farm that produces 99% of the animals that are eaten in this country. And none of you will have any luck. And if you do have luck, it's because you're being shown a show farm.
We had people from sort of the new butchers movement, right? There's a very popular, apparently popular young butcher in the Williamsburg section who's all about being able to tell people where the meat came from. And he was on with Marissa Gugliana, president of Soma Direct Meats and author of a forthcoming book called The Butcher Book. And listen to how she described this kind of sustainable meat movement.
It's about sustainability in a lot of ways. If we're going to make the food chain shorter and get closer to the source, then we absolutely have to have butchers that know what to do with these whole animals that they're getting from the farms. And I heard Dario Cecchini, probably the world's most famous butcher, speak on this last Saturday in San Francisco, and he said really eloquently, I am the piece of the chain that gets the meat from the farm to the table.
All right. And we have one more clip of her where she talks specifically about knowing where the meat comes from and how some vegetarians these days are getting back into meat eating through a certain gateway.
think bacon is actually usually more the gateway drug than butchery, but I do think that a lot of people who are moral vegetarians are making the switch to eating meat when they know where it comes from, they know the farmer.
And that's so interesting to me, Jonathan, in the context of your book, because we had calls from people that, you know, that day who were kind of these ambivalent, almost vegetarian, almost meat eater. It sounds like kind of like you, since you have gone back and forth in your life, falling off onto the at least the possibility that there could be such a thing as sustainable and know where it comes from meat eating. Did you look into that?
I did. I mean, it's unfortunate that this conversation is so often framed as a dichotomy. Either you eat meat or you don't. Either you are concerned with animals' welfare or you're not, when in fact a great surprise in the course of researching this book was finding these hidden alliances. We tend to think of farmers and, let's say, PETA activists as being on opposite ends of this conversation spectrum. It's not true. They're at the same end of the spectrum. At the opposite end is factory farming. So when I hear, you know, this woman, this butcher talking, there's nothing she said that I have any kind of, you know, repulsion to or even strong disagreement with. I think that the values that guide her work and the values that guide a PETA activist's work are almost identical.
So your campaign would be what? To get factory farming illuminated and abolished?
To get it totally abolished. I mean, it's a system that can't really be fixed. Unfortunately, we often talk about giving chickens another 2 square inches in their cages. We talk about, offering some modicum of waste treatment for pig lagoons. But it's a system that can't be fixed because it's based on a series of lies, or at least half-truths about who we are and what animals are. One thing that I would say, though, in response to that butcher is that I agree with this perspective that there is a way of making meat that can be humane. I went to farms where farmers treat their animals better than I treat my dog. I mean, there's a difference. I don't kill my dog after a couple of years. But that's not actually the most important difference. But the thing that's absent from this conversation is the scale that we're talking about. Those kinds of meat producers are less than 1% of what's available. And if those people are going to endorse what they do, they also have to say, to present a fully honest argument, you really can't eat meat in restaurants. You really can't buy meat from supermarkets.
Jonathan Safran Foer, my guest on WNYC, his new book, Eating Animals. You mentioned your dog, George, right?
George.
Comes up frequently in the book. In fact, some listeners may remember your op-ed piece in the Times about dog parks, where you managed to throw in a quick vegetarianism pitch while writing about George running around. What role did George play in your life and in this context?
She's probably listening right now, so I should err on overstating it rather than understating it. But basically, I was somebody who didn't care for animals for most of my life. I didn't find them charming. I didn't have any desire to pet or feed them. In fact, I was afraid of them. So about 5 years ago, I was walking down the street in Park Slope with my wife, and there's this little puppy curled into the corner, into the curb rather, wearing an Adopt Me vest. And why do we like some things and not others? I have no idea, but I liked this animal. I knelt down, I pet it, we walked home. My wife grew up with dogs, always imagined having a dog, and I said, you know what? If you wanted to adopt that dog, I would probably say okay. And so she said, let's go adopt that dog. And we did. And it was not exactly love at first sight. I had to overcome my various discomforts with her. I still do. But living with an animal and recognizing not just the similarities but the differences. I think the differences are a lot more powerful than the similarities, you know, the bridges that can't be crossed, made me think differently about what animals are, and also what I am as a person. The sort of biblical concept of dominion is relevant to everybody. One doesn't have to be religious to feel the strong appeal of that.
In fact, Marie from Brooklyn wrote in to ask, is kosher meat any safer? You have an opinion about kosher meat? And safer might be the wrong question, but that's the way
right.
She asked it.
By safer, she might just mean better. I think it's wrong to make generalizations. There are certainly kinds of kosher meat production that are better than factory farming, and there are some examples like agriprocessors, which recently went out of business but was the largest supplier of kosher meat in the world and was basically the bottom of the barrel. I mean, it was as bad can be. One thing that I can say about kashrut is that the ideas that many people seem to think drive it are humility and a humane treatment of animals. If we're going to do this thing, it's a sort of compromise that was made. If we're going to do this thing, we're going to do it by certain rules that allow us to be humans in the way we want to be. And that has been almost entirely sucked out of the practice. Now there's a growing, burgeoning movement, very local. It comes out of New York, in fact, of creating a more a kind of kosher meat that is more in line with these ideas.
And you talk about how if you embrace these ideas, it's almost impossible to eat meat out anymore. But did you find something about KFC being committed to animal welfare in some way?
Well, KFC, which you might know, doesn't signify anything anymore. It's no longer Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's just KFC. I say in the book that it's entirely possible that they're the company that's responsible for more suffering than any company in the history of mankind. They order about 1 billion chickens a year. Try to get your head around that number. That's a lot of chickens.
Couldn't fit them into your Brooklyn apartment.
No, not comfortably. But they, as all of these companies do now, suggest that they're interested in animal welfare. Why do they suggest it? They suggest it because people are demanding it. You know, cage-free and free-range eggs are now the fastest-growing sector in the supermarket, in the food industry. So people want to know where their food's coming from, and they want to feel that it's something that would be acceptable to them if they could view it, if these distances could be bridged. And it's a total joke. I mean, it's a total joke. The people on their animal welfare board are all the legitimate folk have resigned because absolutely no movement was made in the direction of the recommendations they were giving, and now it's occupied basically by their suppliers. So they say that they're monitoring their suppliers, but it's the suppliers who are monitoring the suppliers. So, you know, there are very few things that I would – as I said, I don't like to make generalizations here because it's complicated. One thing I would say is never eat at KFC.
We have 30 seconds left. This brings into question the very definition of free range, doesn't it?
Well, all of these labels, I mean, they just can't be trusted, free range or cage free. Either they literally have no definition and it's left for suppliers to sort of supply their own evidence that this would be the case, or the definitions, as in the case of cage free, are so literal that they mean nothing. You know, to say that something is cage free also allows 30,000 birds to be in one room with no access to the outdoors and about the size of a legal sheet of paper for each. So all I can say is, if you really want to eat this stuff, go see it yourself. Go to a farm. Any good farmer will let you see his farm.
Jonathan Safran Foer, his brand new book is called Eating Animals. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.